From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show. Hey, hello everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Special episode this week. It's just me and Eric Zolliver, our man in Los Angeles. And I am John Grace, your host from the Rockies, Colorado. This week we're having a very, very, very special episode. We're going to talk about Long Arm, a obsession that Eric got me into a few years back. Hunter and Stu have not bitten the bullet on this addiction and consider themselves lucky, I suppose. But Long Arm is a series of, let me pull up the Wikipedia here, because I got to be sure about this, because it's pretty staggering. Long Arm has a, 436 paperback volumes. It is an adult Western series. It is really probably the franchise that kicked off the adult Western boom in the 70s. This does not mean sophisticated, grown-up, mature Westerns. This means pornographic. If they were movies, it'd be X-rated. I guess Western paperbacks with a lot of sex and violence and graphically depicted. There was, did Jake Logan, did that thing come out first, Eric, of Playboy Press?
I'm disclaimer, I am not a huge aficionado of adult Westerns from the 70s and 80s. I guess I'm sort of an aficionado of these guys right yeah. here. I have dabbled into others. The other day I read from the Crow series, that Piccadilly Circus stuff is called, because they're made, were written by Brits.
Right.
That was horrible. It was really boring. That was a lot sleazier than these guys. We'll get into that in a little bit.
Right.
That was way sleazier because Crow is a character that has no qualms about banging underage women. And I mean way underage women.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, and also there was a lot more violence in the way that, I think it's also Piccadilly Western, Edge is written by a Brit too, right? Or British?
Yes, it is. I think that was first. I think those were published early, and they were a hit for the publisher Pinnacle, and Pinnacle gave us basically started the men's paperback boom with The Executioner and The Destroyer and various other series, The Butcher and The Death Merchant, and they branched into Westerns, and Westerns were still selling very well in paperbacks at the time, and Edge was their big Western import, which I guess it was somewhat of a success in England, and Edge is probably more, I would say, Italian Western inspired. I'd say it's like a spaghetti Western. In fact, sometimes I think the ad copy made it sound like that, because those were doing, probably getting a big audience on television. Edge was adapted into a Shane Black TV pilot for Amazon. Wasn't bad. Wasn't great. You see some potential there. Could have been a lot of fun.
Where did you see it?
I saw it when Amazon did sort of a thing where they allowed you to view different pilots and you voted on them. And I think there was a Chris Carter pilot with like an end of the world scenario. It didn't get picked. The Shane Black pilot for Edge did not get picked.
Who played Chris Carter?
What's that?
Who played Chris Carter?
Oh, no, Chris Carter is the creator of the X-Files. He did.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of who is it? I'm thinking of the detective later turned into a sort of spy character in a series of novels in the 60s, but he's been around.
You're thinking of Nick Carter.
Nick Carter, yeah.
Not the singer. Not the singer, I might
Nick
add.
Carter, a character I believe started in the 1890s and was portrayed by Robert Conrad in the 70s television
right.
movie.
And some Czechoslovakian actor in
that's right.
Nick Carter in Prague, or
which is a wacky film.
Yeah, I loved it. Like, I watched it. It was on Amazon Prime for a couple of years, and I was able to finally see it. I'd read about it for years. I guess it was a cult favorite in a Los Angeles art theater. They'd run it every now and then, but I thought it was just great. But nothing like the Nick Carter stories, which, I think he started before Sherlock Holmes when he was a detective.
It's possible. I could have sworn Sherlock Holmes came in by 1888, but I could be wrong. Yeah. I'd have to check on the the Library of Alexandria of the internet, Wikipedia for that one. Yeah, what I've noticed from the Piccadilly Cowboys, Edge, now this Crow that I've just been reading, I've noticed that their violence is way more gruesome than anything you're going to find in the Long Arm series, right. Although there's exceptions to that. And Jake Logan and all these, the Gunsmith, they're not overtly violent in the way that those books are. Those books, like, obviously get off on being as audacious as possible.
Right.
But basically what sets these guys apart is just the sex. Early on in the series, they would depict sex in kind of a colorful ways, like, you know, a blowjob would be a French lesson.
Right.
And things like that. And then later on, unfortunately, like post 90s, I read some of those and they're all really bad. I don't recommend any of them. And all of the sex scenes are more frank,
yeah,
in today's vernacular, which I thought it lost a lot.
It does take a lot out of it when it sounds like it was written by, you know, somebody pandering to the boys' locker room in high school more than actually just writing a Western novel. And that is what is cool about the early ones, because you were telling me to check them out. And I had seen these my entire life. Stacks of these in used bookstores. When I worked at a used bookstore, we had a huge, they always came in. There was a huge collection. This is in the 80s. So they were very popular. And I think my grandfather had a few, because he would just go through grocery bags of Western paperbacks. And this is more common with the Greatest Generation and also the generation before that my grandfather was part of. He was not in the Greatest Generation. He was like World War I age. But they didn't necessarily like television that much. I think they considered it bad for you. And they just read Westerns. They could read two Westerns a night and it wouldn't be that unusual. And he would go through bags of them and he'd read some of the Long Arms. And at the time I was getting into Louis L'Amour, and I asked him about the Long Arms. He's like, avoid those. Those are just trash. You know, he read a few, but I don't think he liked them that much. But he's like, hey, it's a free paperback. And he and his buddy would just like exchange giant grocery bags of Western paperbacks. And that was in between him watching Bonanza on TV, which was being rerun every day. And I think The Big Valley on the weekends. And Gunsmoke also on Saturday night. So the Western was very... It was pretty much the genre for men of that generation. And that included TV, movies, books. Now it's, gosh, I guess it's these stupid superhero things and a lot of bad science fiction. But back then, everybody loved Westerns. And whatever cultural, you know, reasons for that, you can, I'm sure there's a bunch of theories about it. But the Long Arms were very popular. On Facebook, I friended an author who wrote some of them, James Reasoner, and he actually said that back in the mid-70s, when the Long Arms launched, Jove Books published them, so it wasn't some trashy mafia tax shelter outlet like Pinnacle is said to be, which was supposedly a front for the mob, how ironic, because they published Mac Bolan and, you know, War on the Mafia and all that stuff. talk about the perfect cover. Long Arm was put out by Jove Books, which was a real publisher. And apparently they sold so well. And at the time, Louis L'Amour was king of the Western paperbacks. You could go to a grocery store where a Walgreens would have like six aisles of paperbacks. The Western section was like 80% Louis L'Amour. Like Bantam Books had just saturated the market with Louis L'Amour. Long Arm comes out and it sells so great, like staggering numbers, that Louis considered writing adult Westerns. And his editor talked him out of it. Oh, this is a trend. It's not going to last very long, you know. And his editor was right. I would say it probably died off by the mid 80s, where only Long Arm and I think the Gunsmith were still publishing. Jake Logan, I think, was also still publishing. And that started at the Playboy Press, I believe. And but there were a ton of these different series. I'm not even going to go into the numbers or different titles, because there's too many of them. And there was a point where I was reading Long Arm and I wanted to try to explore more because I was digging the Long Arms well enough. And I was trying some of these other ones. And I was just like, eh. Even the sister series Lone Star was, which was sort of like a canon film version of, like, if Sybil Danning and Sho Kasugi teamed up for a Western movie for canon films, that would be a Lone Star novel. But it was just like the other ones I read, they weren't as good. And also, strangely enough, they have a lot of the same writers, because Long Arm, it's a house name who writes them, Tabor Evans. Tabor Evans, who is a house name for Lou Cameron, James Reasoner, Will C. Knott, Harry Whittington. I know Pete Brandewold wrote a lot of the later ones. It's sort of it's a house name, so you can put out a book a month, and that's how many there are. There was a book every month for Long Arm, so you get 12 a year. So that's why it's in these crazy numbers, like 400, which
from the late 70s all the way up until 2015.
Yeah, that would probably be the longest running paperback series, I think.
It may very well be.
Yeah, because Mac Bolan, I forget when Mac Bolan was canceled, but that was like 5 or 6 years ago. And that had like a 4-year, 5-year jump. I guess the Destroyer is still publishing, so maybe that's the longest, but there's
maybe
not
the
as many.
Longest running adult Western. We'll give it that scope.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely outlasted everybody. And of course, the first 50 or 60 have these really great covers, these kind of wraparound binding cover. It's fantastic. That's what caught the eyes on the paperback rack. Imagine that. It was just like having a real good movie poster. They're very sleazy covers. Of course, young men would look at them today and think they were romance novels, because that's how the pop culture perceives them now. But they're pretty sleazy covers. I just grabbed like a stack of a few off my shelf. You obviously grabbed a couple of stacks off your shelf.
Just a few, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if this is visible. My apologies.
That's a great cover. Yeah.
Number is that? This is 22, Long Arm and the Ghost Dancers. And
you gave your little origin story.
Yeah.
As to how you were introduced to it. I was introduced to, you kind of described it already. I was in a antique shop in North Carolina in the summer of 2010. And there was about 15 of these things.
Right.
And I didn't have enough money to buy them all. They were all going for $1. I mean, I actually probably did have the money to buy all of them if they were that cheap. They were going for $1, $1.50. However, I didn't know what the quality was. So I was just like, I'll buy two.
Right.
I'll buy the two of the best covers. And because that's what caught my eye. These covers are great.
Yeah.
This is number 46, when it still looks good. There's some wear, unfortunately, but
Ooh. You
can see. And then
here's 16. There we go. My apologies to people who listen to audio only, but
look at this one. I mean, we could do covers later.
Yeah,
but this is one of my favorites because this is the Dinosaur Wars, which is actually a historical thing that happened. I think only one guy got shot, but archaeologists were like fighting for, you know, sites out west. Right. You could see the dinosaur bones in the back.
Right, and you can see a prostitute, I believe, with a.
Of course, she's got a sheet over her naturally. This is one with a knight. You can't tell because there's wear on his face.
Right.
That there's a guy dressed in knight armor.
Gosh.
That's the villain of this particular one.
How wild west.
Yeah. Well, they got pretty wacky sometimes. I mean, there's only so many times you could write the same western story over and over, so you had to play around with the genre a bit, which we could talk about soon. But these. They're basically little pieces of art, like you said, movie posters. And then by about in the high 50s, they started looking more like what you would expect a romance novel to look like. This is very Fabio. It's very photorealistic artwork.
Yes.
I don't know if you could tell that. So they started going downhill, and then they started really going downhill post 98, where you're getting covers like this.
Yeah.
Photoshop, ugly, no... nothing. It just looks like a cobbled mess of faces. In fact, sometimes what they do here, this is Ricardo Palacios from Coming At You. That guy over here. They would do that. I've seen Raquel Welch from Bandolero or maybe 100 Rifles about a dozen times on these things.
Yeah, I've got at least 10 with her on the cover. And then I've even got one with Tony Anthony as Blind Man.
Yes. Yeah. You told me about that one. I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah, I wish I'd been able to find it before this, because mine are kind of scattered around. But I'll have to put something in the group when I find that one again. I'll put the cover up or something and try to find it.
All these things.
Yeah, but I think I've seen Dean Martin on the cover of one. I'm pretty sure. Like,
you got Ghost Dancers. I got Snake Dancers.
Jeez. And I mean, you go to any decent used bookstore with a Western section, you'll be able to find these. Like,
they're not scarce anymore, because a lot of oldsters who had these in their collection for years, they're dying, and so people are just dumping them at the store now.
Yeah, I bought about 50 or 60 at a library sale a couple of years ago. Apparently, some dirty old man left his entire adult Western collection. And I just, on bag day, I just grabbed them all. Nobody else wanted them. And so here I am carting out of adult Westerns to my car, to my RAV. And I'm like, damn, I got a ton of these. Of course, then I'm going through them, and all the off series are just awful. Like, I just, some of the Gunsmiths were decent that I read. But the other series, there was one Chet Cunningham created that was just really, it started that whole modern slang and, you know, vernacular for a Western, which never seems right. You know, you want them talking kind of like they would in a Western, even if it's, you're basically reading violent pornography. But I've really filled in the gaps on my long arm collection and still sorting through them. I also was able to, when you put me on the hunt for them, telling me to check them out, I was like, okay, I read one, I think it was Long Arm and the Wendigo or something, an early one. And it was really good. Like, the formula was established. It had a mystery. They always, like, Long Arm, for those who don't know, Gustus Long, who is a federal marshal, and he is sent by Billy Vale on various assignments out of Denver, Colorado. Hello. So they mentioned locations I know, Colfax, Cherry Creek, and all these things. So I'm trying to picture what they were like in the old days. And I don't know if the author did a whole lot of research, but they have it where it's like, I live in a suburb of Denver, and whenever they mention it, he'll be like, he'll take a half a day's train ride to, you know, where I am, and it'll be like 10 minutes, you know, by car. So it's pretty funny when you read that sort of thing. But or he's often going to Wyoming. That's a common location, because Wyoming's actually not that far from Denver, particularly Cheyenne. It's, you put me on the hunt, I read Long Arm and the Wendigo, and I like that. And I like the formula. There's always a mystery. The better ones have a mystery to them.
Most of them are mysteries. I don't think I've ever read one that's not, quite frankly. Some are flimsier than others in terms of the mystery element, but they're always, there's always an attempt at a whodunit.
Yeah, and which is enjoyable, because it's like, you want that kind of formula. It helps you get around the parts where Long Arm's visiting the bordello and interrogating a potential witness. And then you get these sex scenes that seem like they came out of paperback adult pornography novels 101. Like, they just had a whole bunch of paragraphs they could just put in there and slap the names on or whatever. But the early ones are better, because they use that old-fashioned language. And I started buying them, and just, you could buy a stack of them off of a guy on eBay for like $20. And that's what I did. I ended up getting a bunch of the later ones, which were awful, but, you know, I was kind of going through quite a few of them, and a few were decent. Every now and then you get a decent one, or you get one with a great idea. Like, there was one, I forgot the title, where it was like a bunch of former Union commanders were in a old Western town, and they were getting knocked off by supposedly a possible ex-Confederate, I believe was the mystery. It was pretty good for about 100 pages, but then just kind of, you could tell maybe the ghostwriter got bored with it. For the show, I read one you kept recommending, saying it was really exceptional. Was Long Arm and the Crying Corpse, which I just finished this afternoon. I'm showing it to the Zoom camera and frustrating our audio only listeners. But, you know, we might as well make this new YouTube format kind of interesting.
Number 219 came out in 1997. I have the exact month here, if that's of any interest. March 1997. Now, typically, this late in the game, I would not recommend reading any of these.
Right.
Because some of the more quality stuff is the first 50, with the exception of the first book, believe it or not. The first book is really bad. The first book I read was the second one, On the Border.
Right.
which opens up with a scene and with him and a woman. I think she says, "Mount me like a mare."
Well, Crying Corpse, the only sex scene is between him and a prostitute, and she's giving him one for free. She rides him like a bucking bronco or something like that.
Bucking bronco, yeah. There's a few standouts. Crying Corpse is one of them. I just ran into this one. I forget exactly where, but it was obviously the cover did not catch my eye like some of the earlier ones did.
Right.
But you start seeing a drop off in quality story-wise and mystery-wise somewhere in the 90s.
Yeah.
Or in the hundreds. And so it's a general rule of thumb, just kind of stay away from all that stuff. However, after reading this one several years ago, and also reading the one that I'm currently reading, which is no great shakes, but it's actually a pretty damn good one, Long Arm and the Man-Eaters, which has him going down to Tivoli, Texas, investigating two bodies that their hearts were ripped out.
Jeez.
People think that a tribe of Indians, a real tribe of Indians, I looked this up, that had all these pesky rumors about them actually being cannibals. Apparently that's been debunked
right
as of the past few decades. And I have a feeling that the book is going to lead to a point where it's actually white guys dressed as Indians.
Yeah.
I'm getting all sorts of signs of that happening. I'm on page 80 of 150. But that one so far, it's really good. And that's from 1994. So I'm starting to wonder, if there was a rise in quality sometime in the mid 90s.
It's possible. That's about when James Reasoner started. He did not write the Crying Corpse book, but some of the ones he wrote, like Long Arm and the Voodoo Queen, tend to have a bit more pulp magazine and B movie influence. And he even admits to it. He says, yeah, I got to sneak in some H. Rider Haggard type stuff in there. And so his might have more creative ideas. I liked Voodoo Queen when I read it. And that's like, I forget which number that is, but that's in the 200s.
But did he go to Louisiana or Jamaica for that?
It's in Louisiana. It's a New Orleans, of course. But
he ever left the country? He must have, I'm sure, at some point.
I think I've got one or two where he's in like, in a unique setting like that, but I've got to read them, you know, actually got to get in the mood to read it. It's tough to read a bunch of these all at once, you know, because the formula kind of gets to you.
I burnt out, but yeah, I got into them in 2010 after, because I read some good quality ones. It was that number 58, No Man's Land is also a very good one. I read those, that one and On the Border, and those are quality entries. And I was just like, I got to get more of these.
Yeah.
And so I started, and I was reading them like a fiend. For about a year, maybe two, and I kind of dropped off a little bit because you burn out, you know.
Right.
But yeah, he goes all over the place. The 400th book in the series, I think it's called The 400 Blows. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be a double entendre or not. Yeah, that takes place in Florida. It's okay. I believe it's a James Reasoner one.
Uh-huh.
He's gone to New York with Long Arm and the Eastern Dudes. Barbary Coast, which is in San Francisco. There's one where the location itself is wacky. I think it's, I have it here somewhere in the stack. I saw it. Long Arm and the Desert Duchess, which I swear, here it is. It's a snake on the cover. I'm sorry for the glare. Which I swear, whoever wrote this one, they probably saw Charlie Chan, Castle in the Desert.
That's it's exactly very likely. What it is. Yeah, very likely. Yeah,
that's exactly what it is. And he goes out to investigate murder and or some nonsense, and he ends up at this castle in the middle of a desert, and it turns into a spooky old time haunted house sort of thing with creaking doors and trap doors and secret passageways and things.
Right. Well, that's kind of the fun of it is you get more of that pulp magazine invention, you know, like something like The Shadow or The Spider, except you get a Western hero and kind of whatever unique scenario they could dig up for it. But I guess we should go into the movie because we found out later on after you got me kind of hooked on these that these things I've avoided get seen my entire life. And then I'm kind of hooked into them for a while. There was a TV movie adaptation, and what was the year? Let me pull up that IMDb. Okay,
1988 was released March of 1988.
Okay, Yep, and directed by Virgil Vogel, who's a bit of a TV craftsman or hack, and stars. It's funny because the IMDb doesn't even list who stars as Longarm until you go down to the cast list. It's John Terleski.
And not everybody's listed at all.
Yeah.
It's been, I mean, that's probably something that had no ratings at all. I'm sure nobody watched it. It was, yeah. I had known about it for quite a while. I'd known about it for about maybe a year or two into reading these things, but there was no way to ever see it outside of going, nefarious sites.
Right.
Which I don't usually do. But then I just asked John Charles on Facebook, say, hey, did that by any chance the Cinema Gideon have, I shouldn't be throwing him under the bus this way, do they have the TV movie Long Arm from 1988? And he got it for me, and that's how I saw it. Because I'd been wanting to see it for a while. I expected nothing good.
Right.
And what I got was an interesting movie, if you're a fan of the series. It's not good, but it's an interesting film.
Well, it's obviously a setup for a series. Like, it totally feels like a pilot movie. Because it's only, it would have run in a 90-minute time slot, which is usually, because it's only, what is it, an hour and seven minutes,
so it's like a ton of commercials.
Yeah, so it's a 90-minute movie slot, which basically is what you do if you premiere a first episode and you say a special movie presentation. And everything is set up where you have the recurring characters. Like there's an attractive woman running a hotel who's got the hots for Longarm. And of course, he's kind of takes advantage of her, but doesn't get physical with her. So it's kind of, you could see how that was going to work out for a series if it was greenlit.
They've had a relationship before. It seems to be heavily
right. And then they had the young orphan, which was a character that I thought must have come out of one of the books I haven't read, because she had all the quirks of something they would throw in there to throw the series reader off.
With a dirty mouth.
Kid with a dirty mouth and knows everything. Kind of streetwise kid. There was no Billy Vale. I was surprised.
No, there is a Billy Vale surrogate. His name is something Grand, I believe. He is a federal marshal. He resembles Billy Vale. I guess he's a little bit thinner than Billy Vale would be, the way he's described in the books. He's a overweight, late into middle age guy.
Right.
But he's not named Billy Vale. And he treats Longarm basically the same way that Billy Vale does in the books. Longarm and him have a, how would you describe that relationship? A volatile one, but also there's great respect there.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, Harry Callahan's a bad example, because Callahan absolutely hates his superiors and his superiors hate him.
Right.
But there's a mutual respect there, but they're constantly at odds.
Right.
And Billy Vale's tired of dealing with Longarm's nonsense, his womanizing and so forth. In fact, most of the times a book will open up with him coming into the office, having slept over at some lady's house or something the night before. And Vale makes a comment about that. Not the crying corpse.
Right.
As you pointed out, Crying Corpse is very much an anti-Longarm novel in almost every way.
Yeah, it's gruesome. It's there's no actual sex scene until maybe the last 30 pages. There's Longarm looking at a nude prostitute. You get descriptions. It actually opens with Longarm having a wet dream, which was really strange. And it's about this gruesome, just really awful murder of an underage prostitute. And the whole way it's set up, it's almost like an anti-sex novel. It's just so, it is not trying to be a turn on at all for the reader. It goes into these descriptions of it's like, obviously the author, and by the way, the author of this is not known. We don't have them credited anywhere. We don't know who wrote this, and it's a bit off formula. Maybe they'll let themselves be known once this podcast drops, because I think we're doing the first ever podcast on Longarm. But the Crying Corpse, it was obvious the writer had seen Seven and probably some other serial killer movies at the time, and probably read some books, because the descriptions are straight out of one of those dark serial killer novels of the 90s, which were a huge boom because of Thomas Harris's success. And it's quite a read. It's unfortunately has the modernized slang and cursing and everything that just kind of throws you off. It had the old style language, it would have been maybe the greatest long arm novel of all. But it is a fascinating read because it's almost like it's gruesome enough to be like a horror novel.
It's striving to be something other than it is,
yeah,
without a doubt.
And it's like, I don't even know if the writer intended to do it. It's just like, because he's just, like James Reasoner says, you were basically paid enough to buy your groceries for a couple of months, you know, for writing one of these.
Oh, so, it couldn't have been very much, yeah.
No. Yeah, and he said, Longarm bought my groceries for me and my wife for a few years. But the writer really achieved something. This, it's unfortunate we don't actually know who it is, but it's pretty good in the mystery solution. I mean, you can kind of see it coming if you've read a lot of mysteries, but it's a pretty good solution when it happens. The twist is unique enough, and the action is well described. It's got sort of a Day of the Outlaw snowbound setting, being snowed in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which has happened to me using a car. Me and my wife had to spend the night in a hotel in Cheyenne because they closed the roads for snow. It's a really good one. And if you see this in a used bookstore, I would recommend to anybody, get a copy of this one and read it. But keep in mind, it's not really not on the total, what would you say, the path of how these books usually are. It's very off formula.
It's completely off formula. If you're not looking to get into them, I would recommend it. Yeah. I would recommend it if this is the only one you're going to read them.
Right.
I am curious to see, since I my little theory, I only have this bit of evidence, which is the 1994 novel that I'm currently reading. This is not in the same realm. This is Crying Corpse. I don't know where Maneaters is.
Okay.
Maneaters is not in the same realm as Crying Corpse in terms of quality, but it's above average. So I wonder if there was a spike in quality at the time. So I would like to read around Crying Corpse.
Right.
At some point. But isn't there, I don't know how detailed we want to get, but as I recall, because you've read it recently, I haven't read The Crying Corpse. I read it twice, but it's been many years since I've read it. Uh-huh. I think it's due for another read, actually. The scene, he finds the corpse, the titular corpse, he finds her frozen in the snow, and I believe there's discharge on her vagina, and it's
yes,
frozen.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really... It's really grotesque.
It's really creepy. It's really, and it's like, I think the thing is she has a tear running down her eye,
yes,
and it's frozen to her face, which is like the really powerful description there. But the book is quite an experience to read because it's like, I wouldn't be surprised if it was a horror novelist that wrote it, just making some quick money for groceries, basically. Yeah.
I wish it. Yeah.
Like maybe somebody out of the splatterpunk scene, but I don't know who wrote it, but because... Nobody's very forthcoming with who wrote all these. Like Wikipedia can't even find all the writers. So, and even if you go to, there's a few adult Western blogs where they review the paperback Western releases, and they can't even find out who wrote all these things. Because
up until recently, there was no eyeballs and no critical eyeballs on any of these books up until like maybe 3 years ago.
Right.
And you've had that same experience where we've been on men's paperbacks pages and things on Facebook. You post something about long arm, nobody would want to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Right. Like 10 years ago, I had a chance to buy a box of long arms. They were in beat up condition, you know, probably for like $5. I think I only had to pay the taxes on it. But bookstore was going out of business. And it was we're talking a big box, probably the first 100 or so. But I never read them. And I was just like, I'd just seen these my whole life, but never really read. I never read one out of curiosity. So I go on that men's paperback group. I asked them, are these worth getting? Should I go get these? And nobody could give me an answer. Like nobody had ever read them. And one guy was like, hey man, you can hide your weed in it or something. You know, this is how people think about stuff. But yeah. I was just like, okay, I guess nobody's read them and nobody reads these or wants to admit to reading them. I could understand that. It's weird, but like 3 years ago, suddenly people started talking long arm on there as if, it was okay. I think when I found out James Reasoner had written quite a few, that's when I friended him because it was just like, maybe I could learn a little about it. But I think he said like he knew who had written some of them that you see on Wikipedia. But Lou Cameron, I guess, actually wrote the Bible for the series, which is given to all the ghost writers. So it has to be, they're all set in like 1888 or something, or 1881 or 82. And They all have to have like a mystery. They have to have accurate description of guns, but Lou Cameron designed the whole thing. And I guess he wrote the first one, which he didn't care much for. And the interesting thing is I've tried some of Lou Cameron's other work and I can't get into it at all. And he was an old pulp paperback comic book, like writer extraordinaire. I guess he churned stuff out like crazy. And just one of those pro writers that, you know, probably wrote 20 books a year.
Yeah. We got way off the movie though.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to the movie. Right. So Terlesky plays long arm, but does not have the mustache.
And no mustache, no long arm. Sorry.
Yeah, it's not. So he's not really. He's like long arm in name only. And he's
way too young for the role. I believe I could be wrong about this, but I remember several times in the books, long arm has a lot of sayings like, hey, when people are debating amongst each other and he wants to get his word in and the conversation's getting haughty. He's like, whoa, 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 let's just eat this apple one bite at a time and things like that.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the narrator, because it's not first person, they're all third person. The narrator describes long arm. I can't recall if it's on the wrong side of 40 or the right side of 40. I think it's right. The right side of 40, which would pin him in his late 30s.
Yeah. And that's how I always feel when I read him is like he's in his late 30s. He's like skinny, probably like a Burt Reynolds type. Yeah. Except with a more elaborate mustache, you know, but I could see somebody using Bert as a model when they're writing these. Probably, yeah, I would say that be like Bert is the bandit, I think is maybe the idea they were, a writer is visually.
Probably less, I would imagine less kind of Cheshire Cat-ish.
Yeah.
He's not in control of every situation the way Bert is.
Right, right. He's a detective, basically.
Right.
Like maybe McCloud, he's
maybe Weaver. Maybe, but Terlesky is too young for the role, yeah. And he plays him as a smartass,
right?
Like too much of a smartass.
Yeah, he's he's almost like I was thinking it was inspired by Young Guns, but as you found out, it predates Young Guns by like half a year.
Half a year, but we came up with that theory that it's possible the studio knew they had a hit on their hands, not because it was a Western, which we're all dying.
Yeah.
All but dead by 88. This is a few years before the actual Western revival, of which there was one after Unforgiven for a slight bit of time. But however, people didn't go to Young Guns because of the genre. They went because it was the stunt casting.
Yeah, Brat Pack with six shooters, cowboy hats, and dusters.
So it's possible because a lot of the times when they know they got something on their hands, the studio knows in advance by almost a year. And so it's possible that your theory is correct, that the movie got greenlit and has similarities, as in Long Arm, has similarities to Young Guns.
Yeah, and I noticed the producer was Charles Sellers, I believe, who directed Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Deadly Night.
Yeah, and also a bunch of Sun Classics pictures. So I think it had some old Utah hands, you know, involved in this. From guys who used to make stuff for Sun Classics in the 70s, but it appears to have been filmed in New Mexico. I didn't even look that up, but I think
there's a ton of locations. New Mexico, I think, is the main one, but there's a ton of locations because they film usually if a movie of this nature, which is probably not the most expensive thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know, what if there's several towns in your script, then you'll just use the same town over and over, dress it up differently or shoot it from a different angle. They went to three, according to IMDb, they went to three different actual movie ranches.
So they put a little effort into it.
Yeah, all of them all defunct as of the past 5 years.
Interesting. Wow.
All three of them. I looked them up. But yeah, needless to say, the movie's not a lot like the books. However, when it attempts to be like the books, that's when it gets kind of interesting.
Yeah.
There's the Shannon Tweed, blink and you'll miss her cameo, basically. She only has one scene. And that scenario is straight out of a book where he'll show up at, it's very episodic, like a lot of these books are. So he meets a bunch of crazy, kooky characters. And one of them is this widow who's dressed, you know, like a man. And they dressed her down so you don't see that it's Shannon Tweed. And her name is like Crazy Sally or something.
Yeah, Crazy Sally. She's a widow. Yeah. She's the crazy widow.
Right. And so long arm, after getting into a gunfight, he gets shot a lot in this movie, actually. He got shot in the arm and he's wounded. He's traversing through the desert and he stumbles upon Crazy Sally on her homestead. She takes him in. The inevitable happens. And of course, the next morning when long arm wakes up and he's all bandaged up and stuff, she's no longer the woman that he met. It's Shannon Tweed.
And she's Shannon Tweed, straight out of a Playboy lingerie special, basically. You know, straight out of a
sample. Yeah, that character's straight out of the books, really.
Yeah.
Straight out of several of the books. But outside of Custis Long himself, there's nobody actually from the books. Billy Vale is somebody else for some reason. His surrogate is, I forget his name. They give him a bogus origin story where it's that cliche where he's hired to go hunt down his former gang.
Right.
You know? That's not in the books. I don't believe that's Custis Long's origin story at all.
Yeah, I don't even really think he has one in a way.
I don't think he has
one. I haven't encountered that he's yet from, if he does.
All we know is that he's from West by God, Virginia. That's all we know.
Right. Yeah.
And you get the sense that Long is sort of an innocent character in a way, in terms of, like, even though he has sex with thousands of women over the course of the series.
Right.
Early on in the books, like, whenever these women would want to have a little kink or something, he'd be like, well, I'm not sure about that, but I'll go with it. Like, he's just like, he's appalled by these things these women want to do.
Yeah.
It's strange. There's no sense of that with Custis in the movie at all.
Right.
He's up for anything. He's a young guy. Yeah, there's that origin story. And then it turns out in the movie, spoilers, I don't know if anybody cares, the head of the gang members that he's going after is his brother.
Yeah, something like that.
I'm not even certain.
I was very cloudy on that whole thing, and it was a little strange. But it's weird because the pilot movie, it's like half of it's aimed at families, but other half is aimed at readers of the books, because he scores with like three or four chicks throughout the whole thing. I mean, he gets laid more often than Timothy Dalton than his James Bond movies.
He gets laid more often than Longarm does in some of the novels.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like maybe they were trying to, maybe it was sort of a thing where they could all do an alternate edit if they had to, and you know.
Well, it was for television. It wasn't like a Skinemax film. So
right.
And that's really the only way, if anybody were to revisit, I mean, I can't imagine, it's a dead series. If they were to revisit this, it would, if they wanted to do it proper, it would have to be like HBO Max, you know, where they don't care.
Right. The raunchiest Western ever, the bawdiest Western ever. Yeah. And here it's almost like, it's like half a forerunner of something like Briscoe County Jr. You know,
very somebody, I saw a reviewer described it as mildly family friendly. I think that's apt.
Right. But yeah. but then you have like the Daphne Ashbrook character, the outlaw girl, like she's skinny dipping or whatever. And it's just like you have that scene. And it's about as raunchy as you can get for 1988 television. And yeah. I think this was on ABC, which was owned by Disney by then. And so who knows how they were trying to phrase this around or whatever. But it is a strange mix. You know,
I would love to get the story behind this one. Like, I guess the series was still going strong in 88 for them to even bother attempting this at all.
It was selling very well, I could say, because I worked in a bookstore. And
okay.
Boy, we always had the new long arms in stock. And they were coming into the used section, trade-ins, quite often. And it was, you'd still see them everywhere. So, yeah, it was still going well. If it had been weakened, that series would have been canceled by the 90s. Easily. Well,
what eventually killed it might have still been going on today, but what killed it was they took the pornography out of Walmart.
And so that's true. I think they sold great in Walmart. In fact, some of the ones I found from that major library sale hall had Walmart stickers on it. 25% off, discount Walmart every day. Yeah. Really hard to peel off too. You get like a razor blade, you can't get the damn things off. But Walmart military bases, you know, these things sell in a lot of places that most people don't think about as, because when nowadays we perceive reading as just women reading Jack Reacher and some men reading Jack Reacher because they think they're supposed to, and everybody else reading Harry Potter. That's about it. You know, maybe they'll read Stephen King. I don't know who the hell is big these days, but
nobody's reading King today. It doesn't seem likely to me.
Yeah. They're probably making fun of his Twitter more than reading his books these days.
They're reading his Twitter more than there. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can't imagine King moves the meter anymore, but I read one of his more recent books, Mr. Mercedes, which ended up being a TV show, but everything gets a TV show today. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised by that.
Right.
But no, I think people know more of Stephen King from the stuff that gets made out of his books rather than the books themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Because you could mention something like Bag of Bones to people that are going to know what you're talking about, even though it's allegedly sold millions of copies. Who knows what his stuff sells now? But Long Arm, I'd love to get the sales numbers on. That must have been doing pretty well.
I'd love to do a deep dive with people who would know and really like do a little mini doc or something on YouTube. That would be fascinating to me, at least.
Yeah, you talk to John Terleski, and he's saying he grew a mustache.
Don't think I didn't look him up. I mean, he probably didn't read one, you know, book. I mean, it was just a gig for him at the time.
Right.
But Walmart not selling them anymore is what killed the series. And I wasn't even aware. During the period that it was canceled, I had kind of dropped off Long Arm. I wasn't paying attention to it. And somewhere around 2016, maybe 2017, I was like, oh, I wonder where Long Arm's up, what's he's up to now and what number they're up to. And I was just like, oh, wow, gone since a year and a half ago.
Canceled.
Yeah. I did read the end just because I was curious. It was on the shelf at a Barnes & Noble's. They had the last book, which I think is number, who knows, 400-something, 422.
Right.
And they did give him a definitive end. I think he retires with some lady on a homestead somewhere. And it's all done in the last paragraph. It's really cheap.
Writes it off, you know. It's like I would have...
cheap send-off.
I would have rather he gone out like Modesty Blaze and Willie Garvin and just died.
Or if you were going to do it, I wish the author would have... Obviously, they knew it was going to be the last one. I wish the author, and I know it's a paid gig where you probably get paid $1,500, so it's not much. Yeah. But I wish the author would have put a little bit more into it where... there was a finality to the entire novel,
right?
As opposed to just having a regular adventure and then throwing off, this tack on send off at the last minute, basically.
Right.
That would have been good, but I get it. People got to eat, and they don't give two shits about the legacy of some tawdry, piece of garbage.
People care more about an obscure comic book character's continuity than they do with Long Arm. You know, it's a different audience, completely. Yeah. And we're probably the youngest people to ever read a Long Arm novel.
Entirely possible.
It's possible you are the youngest to ever read Long Arm. So
that sent a chill up my spine for some reason.
This will be part of your IMDb bio.
that's a hell of a thing you threw on me just now. the movie, when it attempts the novels, even in small, very small forms, the Shannon Tweed is the closest it ever gets, pretty much. That's exciting to me.
Yeah.
Overall, I hated the first few minutes. I hated the first 10 minutes. I was like, man, this is cheap. This in not in budget, but in just quality. It's just cheap storytelling.
Yeah.
They're throwing every Western trope in the book. It's so dull. And I was just like, this is going to be a rough next 50 minutes.
Right.
And it kind of won me over by the end. It's not good, but... I give it a 5 out of 10, just about as average as you can get. The Shannon Tweed stuff is funny because it reminded me of the book. I like that scene where he meets up with an old gangmate of his mentor, this older guy, where in the brothel where they're having a gunfight while also reacquainting themselves with each other.
Yeah. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. I think that's a cool scene. I think it's well written.
Yeah.
There's a few lines in the movie that shocked me by how good they were.
Right.
Early on, he gets into a show or is about to be in a showdown with this heavier set fella. And the fat guy says, oh, this is not fair. I'm heavier than you are, meaning he's a bigger target. Mm-hmm. And he says, that's okay. We'll just draw a thinner figure around you in the middle of it. And whatever's not inside the lines doesn't count. That's really good.
Yeah, that's actually a good line. One of the gunfighters that he dealt with was Frank Doubleday, the actor who played the gang member in Assault on Precinct 13, who killed Kim Richards, and was also in Escape from New York as the presenting the whole ransom of the president to Lee Van Cleef and his men. It was kind of fun to see him come in and do a pretty cool cameo where he gets shot and killed, gives Long Arm a little body count. But I think the problem is they didn't know if they were aiming this at the family viewing hour, if that's real, or if they wanted to make this a 9 o'clock Western. So they kind of, they tried to have it both ways. It didn't really work, although it would have been offensively stupid if they went with the family thing for the whole hour. I was just like, oh, come on. But I was surprised. It's like, oh, he gets with a prostitute right away. Okay, maybe we're going to get something similar to the books. But, you know, maybe they could have ended it with Longarm lighting a cigar and growing out his mustache or something. You're gonna...
that, yeah, I thought perhaps that was what they were going for. I thought perhaps, is this like the early years, you know? Is that what?
Yeah, yeah, it's a prequel. It's the origin story.
Yeah. You know, but like... he talks directly into camera. He's the narrator of the movie, but he talks directly into camera at the very end.
I thought that was
odd. Yeah, Doubleday is what most people would consider the most authentic person in the film, the most authentic looking person in the film. Everybody else has the thing that everybody complains about where they look like they have freshly pressed clothes and things.
Right.
Doubleday is made to look like a gross slob who just, you know, dragged himself out of the desert.
Right. Looks like a rat, basically.
Yeah. Like a human rat. I don't think he could help that really.
Either, yeah. But, well, he always had a villainous look. And
yeah.
Apparently just the nicest guy, but always had that perfect character villain look. But it was okay. If they got in a series, maybe they could have taken it in different directions. I like you, I give it a 5. It's all right. There was a lot of potential there that they could have messed with. Maybe they could have developed and proved it after a few episodes, but it didn't get greenlit. And maybe because it aired like half a year before Young Guns was released. And had they come in on the heels of Young Guns, they may have actually had something, maybe an actual pilot cell and gone to series. But it's okay. I don't hate it. I'm not offended by it. I don't, you know, come to think of it, I don't think I've ever seen a movie or TV adaptation of any of my paperback favorites that's faithful. It just doesn't, it's just never there. They always miss out on too much. I mean, you could go through Tarzan, you can go through The Destroyer, Remo Williams, you can Doc Savage. It's like you'll never get anything.
The thing you mentioned Doc Savage, you mentioned Remo Williams, you mentioned who else did you mention?
Doc Savage, Remo, Tarzan.
All that stuff. I mean, it's easy to play armchair filmmaker or whatever and say, it's like, why don't they just do it this way? It's so easy. But like that stuff can be probably pretty difficult to pull off, especially with the budgets these things usually have.
Yeah.
Custis Long, it's not that hard.
No.
Just get a guy who can talk folksy and you're pretty much good to go.
Yeah.
There's really not, I don't know how you can screw that up. I saw the Remo Williams pilot. Mm-hmm. Not I've seen the film too, but the pilot, it has its moments too. There's that scene where he runs up the fire hose, the water stream from the fire hose. That's very much something from the novels,
right?
Or would be in line with them. But it's also, St. Andrew is such an ethereal thing in the books that it's hard to really capture that on screen. So that would be hard to do.
Yeah.
Tarzan, the way the novels are written, at least the Edgar Rice Burroughs originals, those can be expensive. They tend to make expensive movies if you were to do it that way, because they're all one long chase scene.
Yeah.
There's always something happening.
Right. And there's a scope to it as well.
Right.
And also a brutality that would take them in the R-rated territory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, Tarzan is unbelievably violent.
Yeah.
Longarm is very simple. Just do a whodunit out west and just do the character proper. It's not, I mean, if you have a budget for a Western, it's not hard to do.
Yeah.
You don't have to get somebody who is physically, physically imposing in clothes, but you don't have to get somebody who has his shirt constantly off and is running around through the trees.
Right.
You know? And
you just need like a young Sam Elliott type.
Yeah.
If they can find him. I mean, you know, get one of those Yellowstone actors or whatever that's young and scrawny, and I think you would have something. Speaking of Sam Elliott,
we have
you've been called out in our group by the Watch This Movie guys about Sam Elliott's quote. Now I will, as of this recording, this has been in the showbiz headlines. Hopefully it will be all over by the time this gets released, but Sam Elliott railed against Jane Campion's Power of the Dog during his visit to Marc Maron's WTF podcast. Campion's drama is nominated for 12 Oscars, more than any film this year. Benedict Cumberbatch, hope I said that correctly, stars as a sadistic rancher who makes life hell for his new sister-in-law and her son in 1925 Montana. That's not really a Western, is it?
What year?
1925.
Okay, well, we could talk about that. I have a thing to say.
Okay. All right, well, we'll get to the heart of the story here. Elliot called the film a piece of shit and seemed bothered by how the film deconstructs classic Western archetypes such as cowboys. Elliot compared Campion's cowboys to Chippendale dancers who, quote, wear bow ties and not much else. That's what all these fucking cowboys in that movie look like, Elliot said. They're running around in chaps and no shirts. There's all these allusions of homosexuality throughout the movie. Allusions? Seems pretty blatant. Cumberbatch's character is a closeted gay man in the film. Maron told Elliot that these themes are what the movie is about, but Elliot remained critical of Campion's approach to the Western genre. Elliot has starred in several Western projects throughout his career, you think, including the recent Paramount Plus Yellowstone prequel series 1883. Where's the Western in this Western? Elliot asked. I mean, Cumberbatch never got out of his fucking chaps. He had two pairs of chaps, a woolly pair and a leather pair. And every fucking time he would walk in from somewhere, he never was on a horse. Maybe once he'd walk into the fucking house, storm up the fucking stairs, go lay in his bed in his chaps and play his banjo. It's like, what the fuck? Elliot said of Campion, what the fuck does this woman from down there know about the American West? Why the fuck did she shoot this movie in New Zealand and call it Montana? And say that this is the way it was, that fucking rubbed me the wrong way. Man, he's got a potty mouth there.
Sam. He sure does, my God. Yeah,
geez, angry man.
I thought he was a rancher.
Elliot, who earned an Oscar nomination a few years back for his performance in A Star Is Born, added, I just came from Texas where I was hanging out with families, not men, but families, big, long, extended, multiple generation families that made their living and their lives were all about being cowboys. And boy, when I fucking saw that, in parentheses, movie, I thought, what the fuck? Where are we in this world today? Power of the Dog is nominated for Best Picture, Best Director. Elliot did call Campion a brilliant filmmaker, despite not agreeing with her overall approach to the genre. The movie is now streaming on Netflix. So, what do you think of this, Eric? What is this really a Western? And, you know, can you remember the question that we were asked in the group?
Or you? I remember it. I remember. I'll get to it in a second. But first, I want to say that I think Elliot is playing a role here. Mm-hmm. I think this is an elaborate advertisement for Yellowstone. I think that's exactly what it is.
I agree. Or 1883, I think the spinoff.
1883, correct. Yeah.
It's called, 1883? I haven't even seen it yet.
1883 is the one he stars in. But I haven't watched it either. I think it's just, I mean, not that it needs an advertisement. I think a lot of people are watching. And when I mean a lot of people, I mean pretty much every boomer. And I mean, it's doing well.
Yeah. Yellowstone's so great. We actually, Hunter and I had discussed it on the previous show, that Yellowstone is definitely like, that's the drama everybody talks about now. That's the only water cooler show probably in existence right now.
I'm happy that it's a Western, even if I'm not watching. He's playing a role here. He doesn't really, who knows if he even saw Power of the Dog? I don't know. But he's doing the thing that I've seen done before, which is shit on the thing that's like my shit that's currently out.
Yeah.
You know, to get eyeballs on what he's peddling. So right. I think that's what's going on. I don't think he was that offended. It's not like it's the first time we've seen a gay cowboy movie. Come on.
Give me a break. Right.
As for Power of the Dog, I don't know. I have a screener right there. I'm probably never going to watch it. I don't like Benedict Cumberbatch. I can't watch him in anything. He looks like a genetic accident to me. I just can't. And also, I just don't, not that I'm a loyalist to Star Trek. I like the show, the original.
Yeah.
But I don't like that he lied to everybody about not playing Khan when he was clearly playing Khan, and it came out like 8 months later. But yeah, he was on, no, we're not doing it. And I understand he probably has an NDA or whatever the contract says. It was just like, just come up with a more clever way of not answering the question.
Right. Jason Momoa, I think, handled that really well when he was asked, are you signed to play Aquaman? And he just had a great way of avoiding it. You know, he would pretend he couldn't hear the question, or he'd say, hey, dude, meet me out in the back alley. You know, he had a good way of kind of brushing it off.
That's good. Yeah. And I mean, I wasn't planning on liking Benedict Cumberbatch even before that, but that really rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah. It's going to be hard when I go see that Doctor Strange movie that Sam Raimi directed, because I want to see a Sam Raimi movie, but I'm going to go see it in the bargain theater. I'm going to make that
compromise. That's your big F you.
Yeah. Yeah. See it.
I would love to see a Sam Raimi movie. I just don't know if it would be a Sam Raimi movie. It's just going to be a Disney Marvel movie, really, I think.
Yeah. That's what I'm afraid of, because I did not care for the first Doctor Strange. And that's one of my favorite old characters from the old comic books. And they didn't handle it too well at all. Better off of that TV movie. Kind of the TV movie that was like Long Arm. It was like the pilot movie, but I thought they did a better job.
They threw the same money that they're throwing the Doctor Strange into the multiverse, whatever the hell it's called. If they threw the same money and actually did practical effects for all those kooky monsters, I'd be there.
Yeah. But stop motion monsters, get some Japanese style men in suits, puppet monsters, just go crazy with it. They're like Evil Dead 2, you know?
Yeah. Do that. And I'm there first day. But otherwise, no, I don't care.
It's hard to care for anything that comes out these days. Anyway,
what's the one that's coming out this weekend? I hope it's good. Please let it bomb.
There's one coming out this weekend?
Yeah, or sometime soon. It's Jared Leto as a vampire, Morpheus or something.
Morbius. I'm probably going to go see that because it looks like a stupid monster movie.
I hope it bombs.
I hope it does too. But it won't, because people are so hungry for entertainment. They want this childish fantasy stuff. You know, I know. We're not getting an R-rated Long Arm movie anytime soon. Even though I think there's potential gold there, I think. But then again, I don't know who watches this type of stuff. Yeah, you know, who watches Westerns these days? Unless you got like a Taylor Sheridan. If Taylor Sheridan just put his name on it, I think that might help. That would actually sell it.
The Western is going through a little resurgence right now. It's just it's in between. It's all the prestige Westerns, which are, in the case of Power of the Dog, is a perfect example. Another one is Hostel. It's all the prestige Westerns are lame because they're drowned in PC nonsense.
Yeah.
And you can't do that with that genre.
No, you can't. It's it doesn't fit in that framework at all.
No.
And I think that maybe that's why Tarantino's stuff doesn't work, is because he tries to put like a modern spin on things, and it takes you out of it too easily. Because you just know it was.
Both his Westerns suck.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, both those movies suck too. I remember liking Django in the theater. I didn't like the last 45 minutes. It should have ended earlier.
Same here. If I watch it on video, I hate it, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, you will. I think you will. I tried to rewatch it not too long ago, and I was like, this is unwatchable. I can't see this. And then Hateful Eight was always unwatchable.
Yeah. I never tried it. Had too many people. Everybody who recommended it were people who didn't watch Westerns. Everybody who hated it were people who watch a lot of Westerns, and I'm in that latter group. So
if you don't like Westerns, you'll like Quentin's stuff. His Westerns, you'll like it.
Yeah.
It appeals to that. I'm sure that's not what he meant, but it appeals to them. But okay. What makes a Western a Western? I do remember this question, and I'm sorry that I don't have a super eloquent answer for you. It's not a science. It's a feel in the gut, you know? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier, 1925, is this even a Western?
Yeah.
It could be. The Western portion of the United States remained wild well after all of us probably even think it did. All the way up until probably World War II. However, this is my definition. In the classic period, everybody knows. Classic period is post-Civil War, so 1865 to about, I would say 1890, but some people like to stretch that out to the middle, 1895. Like that's the classic period. Anything after that is a late period Western. And then if you go a little bit further, you're talking about Edwardian Westerns, where cars are showing up and planes.
Right.
That sort of stuff.
Yeah.
1925 is very late in the game, but it was only 6-7 years removed from the Mexican Revolution.
That's true.
It can still be done. Now, if you're doing a movie in 1925 that has a bunch of cars in it, like a ton, not just one or two, and you're involving city-like elements, whether they be gangsters or what have you, at that point, it's something else. It's not a Western per se.
Right.
But and stuff like I think it takes place in the 60s, stuff like what's the gay cowboy movie that everybody forgot about? Ang Lee's, what's it called?
Brokeback Mountain.
Brokeback Mountain is not and never was a Western.
Right.
It takes place in the 60s or the 50s.
Yeah.
Their main transportation is a truck.
Same reason Lonely or the Brave is not a Western.
No, Lonely or the Brave is not a Western.
Yeah.
It's not a Western. Just because you have, I mean, I don't even think, I've never seen Brokeback Mountain, but I'm going to assume that there's not even Western elements in it. There's only two guys in cowboy hats.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what right. It comes down to.
Well, it's like people think just because a movie is about crime, it's a noir. And right. It's in black and white. It's an automatic noir. Black and white means noir. And there's a lot of crime films from the 30s and 40s that are not noirs at all.
No.
You know. And as James Ellroy will tell you, it has to have that you're fucked theme, sure. Is what Ellroy always says. Otherwise, it's not a noir. By the way, I told James Ellroy about the Long Arm novels when I was really reading heavy into them. And he pretended or claimed he'd never heard of them. But of course, right away, I get the phallic jokes from Ellroy going, he uses his long arm. The ladies like his long arm. So, you know.
Isn't he trying to get young men to read even trashy novels?
Yeah, yeah. He believes that. And I was there a couple of years ago when somebody had asked him what's something you like that nobody would know you liked or would not expect you to like. And he started mentioning the trash novels of I believe it was it Irving Wallace and Irv the Perv, he calls him, and Harold Robbins. He says, he said, it's better for your brain to read a trash novel from the 70s by Harold Robbins or Irving Wallace than it is to watch any HBO series.
I agree, yeah.
And I agreed with him on that. And then I noticed he started saying that in interviews a couple of years later, like saying, I think, you know, young men need to read and you know, people just start reading, and it's like, and it is alienating to see, but you know, what are you going to do? The culture's changed. The way we consume entertainment has completely changed.
Video games has taken up the hobby of reading for men.
Yeah.
For men. Women are reading more than ever, it seems like.
Right. Well, it's almost like it's the superhero movies, the video games. We're in a kind of childish psychological level of appreciating entertainment.
There's a channel that's a popular channel on YouTube. Mike Malloy sent me a video about it. The title is It's Okay for Stories to End. And it discusses the situation we're in now where all of these infantile franchises don't seem to go away. There's always some sequel or something. They were specifically talking about Star Wars. They also talked about Indiana Jones. And Indiana Jones had its ending. It was called The Last Crusade, and they even ride off into the sunset. And he makes a point of saying that. And I was, it was a very profound video and I liked it very much. And I watched the whole half hour. I recommend anybody watch it because, it talks about, it's very mature in its viewpoint on our generation and the Gen Xers who never got over Star Wars and the millennials and even the Zoomers whose stories that the Zoomers are ingesting aren't even theirs. It's not something they grew up with. So I'd like to get their perspective on it, actually. It's like, are they going to see these movies? And it seems like they are resounding. But it was a video about kind of going against, like, it's okay for this stuff to end and for us to grow up.
Yeah.
And it talked about how the Batman comics were written for children in the 30s and they were still written for children in the 70s.
Yes, they were.
And then somewhere in the 80s, something got confused and a guy, Frank Miller, showed up and screwed everything up.
Yeah, he did.
And I'm not saying that those works aren't great. I've never personally read The Dark Knight Returns. I could probably go without. I've read The Long Halloween, which I know is not Frank Miller. I didn't get too much out of it, to be honest. Get too much out of that at all.
I didn't think it was any big deal when I read it.
It's just a hodgepodge of they threw all the villains in. That's all I remember. I was just like, this is not very good.
Right.
I don't know why it has the status that it has. Also, The Killing Joke, I felt the same way about that.
Yeah.
I don't mind them dabbling in adulthood for Batman. Although arguably that thing that you posted the other day, that the more realistic they make Batman, the more absurd the idea becomes.
Right.
This guy running around in a bat suit.
By the way, that thing I posted the other day on Facebook was a comic strip by David Mazzucchelli, who actually drew Batman Year One. And he wrote that thing saying the more realistic you make Batman or superheroes, the less believable they are. You know, they're on a comic book. You can see Superman flying in outer space and it looks cool. It's like, wow, what a cool piece of art by Neil Adams or whoever. And then you see that in a movie, it just looks like a dork in a Superman costume in front of a green screen. So it just doesn't have that power. It's like when you translate those images to celluloid, it doesn't work at all. It's like, that's why, you know, we tend to gravitate more towards, oh, Eastwood is Dirty Harry or something that's believable. It's more settled in reality, I guess, is the thing.
Right.
Whereas you take this elaborate artsy thing of basically a vigilante in pajamas and, you know, you're supposed to believe that's real. Like, I noticed when I watched the Batman Year One animated movie, because I found it for nothing at Big Lots, and said, okay, I'll check it out again, you know. And then I realized the problem with the Frank Miller version of Batman, if you need Batman to fight muggers, burglars, you know, mobsters, corrupt cops, you just need a better police force. You don't need a guy in a bat suit. You know, you bring the guy in the bat suit in to fight crazy criminals like the Joker or the Penguin, you know, these lunatics that have these crazy identities, you know, because regular law enforcement can't deal with craziness. And that's the only reason you would do it from an adult perspective. So Miller totally screwed everything up. Just the fact that, oh, I hate Robin, I hate Batmite or whatever. It's like, so in other words, he hates all the fantastic stuff that, where in a world where Batman makes sense, a crazy world, he doesn't make any sense in the real world. Yeah, it's comic book world. Like,
yeah. And I see it every day. The LAPD cannot deal with the crazy homeless people.
Yeah.
They're not fully trained to do so. They can't deal with it.
Right. They would need vigilantes and dress up as animals to deal with homeless people.
So furries.
Yes, yes, exactly.
But so the video I saw was very good. I recommend people to watch it. It's called It's Okay for the Story to End, I believe. But my big issue was I saw what else the guy had on his channel, and it all negated his entire thesis. It was all like, I bought these new Hasbro toys, and I'm going to tell you about them. Like, what are you doing? What happened to the thing? You know.
In other words, he had one moment of clarity and made a video. And I forgot to make the video.
More or less what happened, yeah. But to answer the question, I'm sorry, I don't have a definitive answer for our listener, because
it was Mulder who asked the question, if I remember correctly. Mulder,
well, I mean, who am I even to say, who's anybody?
Yeah.
To say what makes a Western and what doesn't. All I know is in my gut, this is how I feel about it. The classic period is about a 30-year period. And then after that, you're toying with the genre, setting it in the late period or whatever the case. But my main issue is, don't push it past 1928. And even though I just said that up to the World War II, but that's just historical fact. That part of the region, parts of the region were still crazy. Don't push it past 1925. And don't have a lot of cars in it. You can have a few. Don't have a lot of cars. Otherwise, it's something else.
Right.
It's something else.
Well, it's like I really got into the radio show, old-time radio show, Tales of the Texas Rangers. And that some stories are set in the early 1900s, some seem to be set in the 1920s. They're set in a Texas that has, people are still on horseback, but they're also using cars and motorcycles. Well,
the Roy Rogers films are like that too.
Yeah.
You know, they're always set in the release date of the film.
Right.
It doesn't bother me there. it seems legit. I don't know.
But, plus, they got to get to the radio station on time to start singing some tunes with Sons of the Pioneers. So.
They have to.
Yeah.
And sometimes a car, you can't go through sagebrush with in a car. You have to go with a horse.
That's right.
Or whatever. I don't know. I just made that up.
Yeah.
So the, so in terms of two gay cowboy movies, I hate that term, cowboy movies. You know, you're dealing with somebody who doesn't know, has never seen a Western when they say, oh, you like cowboy movies?
Yeah. Yeah, you like Rustler's Rhapsody and Gene Autry.
As for the two gay cowboy movies we mentioned, Power of the Dog and Brokeback Mountain, out of the two, I haven't seen either, but I'm going to say Power of the Dog is actually the Western. Because
I would agree, having not seen either, I would say you're probably correct on that.
Yeah, it deals on a ranch, 1925, okay, far off the mark, but whatever, we'll give it to them. It seems, like from what I've seen, it looks like, okay, that's a Western.
Right.
Brokeback Mountain, never did I look at that and say, oh, that's a Western. No, it's not. I mean, that's about all I can give you really in terms of what the definition of the genre means to me. And that's all that it really is. It means that I think most people would maybe agree with me.
Right.
I can give you that.
Yeah. Well, I think, Cormac McCarthy became the writer who kind of redefined the Western for these, maybe Gen X and, millennials, because he was a hip read, I guess.
He was a hit read. Yeah, No Country for Old Men is not a Western.
Yeah.
Taylor Sheridan's movie, Hell or High Water, not a Western. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's a crime film. As is No Country for Old Men. Anything that takes place certainly in the 21st century is not a Western. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a crazy theory. Because I remember my Letterboxd review for Hell or High Water was like, just because they wear cowboy hats and it's set in Texas, not doesn't mean kind of Western.
And they rob banks or whatever.
Yeah.
Other evidence they want to bring in. No, that's poor. That's just poor defining of something.
Right.
And in a way, it cheapens it too, because it could just be anything, you know. What was I going to say? The Power of the Dog. Does anybody get shot in The Power of the Dog?
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
That's a big thing with me too.
Yeah.
Somebody has to get shot.
Right. For me, it rules out Deadwood, because hardly anybody gets shot in Deadwood. They just curse at each other.
Yeah. I saw a few episodes of that show. I've said that story on the show. I saw a few episodes of Deadwood. And I was just like, this is not for me. When somebody gets shot?
Yeah. Nothing happens. They just curse each other out.
Yeah. That's all it is.
Talk like gangster rappers.
Now, there's one particular Western, Joe Dakota, that is a Western set in the classic period. Joe Dakota, nobody gets shot in the film. In fact, there's only a warning shot. That's the only shot that gets fired in the entire movie. But that is very much a Western. So, you know, you could toy around with that stuff. But in general, there needs to be a gunfight. There has to be.
It's true. I mean, it just doesn't seem right. Now, one thing I've always been curious about is it seems like we'll always have a hit Western, Young Guns, Open Range, Unforgiven, but you don't really get a Western boom or trend after that. It's just like you have that movie comes out, makes $180 million, whatever, wins the Oscar, like Unforgiven, or Open Range, where it's a pretty moderate hit that runs, stays in theaters for a few months. But there's no follow through. Like you'll hear from studios, oh, Westerns don't sell. Nobody likes Westerns anymore. Yet some movie just made $100 million for them and they don't.
Well, they made it with Unforgiven. It was kind of different. There was a slight interest in them. They did produce them. I forget what came out first, whether it was Unforgiven or because it was a 1-2 hit punch, very close in proximity to each other. Unforgiven and the Kevin Costner schmaltzy fest with the Indians, Dances with Wolves.
Dances with Wolves. Yeah.
And so we did see a revisiting. The Italians even came back with Franco Nero in Jonathan of the Bears, which the original title of that was Dances with Bears.
Uh-huh.
We had a Jim Wynorski cheapie, Hard Boundary.
Right.
We had a few. I'm forgetting a lot. Okay.
And strangely, John Terlecki was not in it because he was in Wynorski's Death Stalker 2. And that's, I believe, right. He was in Chopping Mall. So
he's one of the kids in Chopping Mall. Yeah.
So it's like we should have Terlecki.
Somebody needs to get him on the horn and talk about Longhorn.
Yeah.
But he's an in-demand director now for television.
Yeah, does a lot of TV, and I remember reading that. I was like, oh, wow. So he found a niche for himself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he's doing a lot. But yes, you're right, mostly. One becomes a hit. One makes the magical $100 million mark, which honestly, these days, I don't even think $100 million is the magical mark anymore.
No.
But once upon a time, it was. Mm-hmm. And True Grit, we don't even have to go that far into the past. True Grit, the remake, not in 2010, made over $100 million. Did you see any Westerns made after that? Not really.
I can't recall.
Not from Hollywood.
No. Yeah. How weird.
Everything around that time, too, the 310 to Yuma remake, they made it seem like it was a hit, but check out those numbers. I don't think it was that big a hit. I think it just made okay numbers.
It had like a good opening weekend.
I went to go see it. I don't think it was opening weekend, but I went to go see it. It was nothing but oldsters in the crowd.
Yeah. I went to see it opening weekend, and I think it was mostly old couples.
Yeah.
Me and my wife went to see it, and it was just like, yep, crowd was just old people, pretty much.
Magnificent Seven remake was the same thing, old people crowd.
Yeah, it's funny because I rewatched the True Grit remake a couple of weeks back, and I couldn't stand it. And I liked it. Well enough in the theater.
I liked it in the theater, yeah.
But on TV, it doesn't hold up at all. The only thing that worked was Josh Brolin's performance, because he played the villain character as a complete idiot. And all of his dialogue was just marble mouth and like telling her, I go back with you. Like, I don't know if they were just having a laugh on everybody, like, or if Josh was just doing that on purpose, but it's the best thing about the movie. And so once he's dead, it's like, okay, this is over. But he's hysterical in that film.
I liked it. I resented all of the talk, mostly from Matt Damon, who's an actor I don't like.
Yeah.
And he's horrible in the film. Oh, my God.
Yeah, he's really bad.
He says lines like he doesn't understand the dialogue. I don't think he did. He doesn't understand what was coming out of his mouth. Because, the dialogue is really flowery. It's straight from the book.
Right.
And I resented the fact that there was all this stuff about how, oh yeah, we're going back to the book on this one. The John Wayne movie didn't get the book right, you know, at all. Like, it doesn't follow. That's a lie.
Yeah.
That is a lie. I'm no big fan of the original True Grit, so it's not like I'm even defending the film, but you know, I don't like lying when it comes to, you know, the rewriting of history here.
Right.
I've read the book and I've watched all two versions of the film, of the book, sorry. Adaptations, the two adaptations, and they're unbelievably similar. All three of them are similar to each other.
Yeah.
There's some things the Coens get better, like the tone, overall tone, I think is closer to the book with the Coens. But there's some things the Wayne movie gets better in terms of being close to the literary work.
Right.
Because some of the stuff in the Coen movies, like the Bear Man and meeting Rooster Cogburn in the outhouse, none of that's in the novel.
Right.
That's all very Coen-esque stuff. I resent that kind of talk about it. I'll probably never watch it again. I'd rather keep my good memories in the film.
I don't advise it. It does not hold up. But so anyway, we've both rated Long Arm, the TV movie, a 5. Yes, we did review a movie in this episode somewhere in the back. We recommend, I believe we would both recommend that you hit some thrift stores, used bookstores, whatever's available to you. Look for some Long Arms, check them out. Keep in mind, we only really recommend like the first 100 in that range, but there are potentially some good ones in the 200s. As for 100 to 200, I can't really say that, like, oh, 157 is great or whatever, because I have started quite a few in that range and didn't get far, like 40-50 pages.
I remember reading one that was around that range where the character went through some changes. He was more or less still Custis Long, but in terms of his firearm prowess, he didn't understand firearms very well. Didn't really know that, like, it was weird. It was a weird read. I was just like, wow, this is a bizarre.
Like the secret writer, he saw Shakiest Gun in the West with Don Knotts that week.
Something. It was a strange read. I would stay far and away from anything post 300. I mean, I have one I'm looking at right now, Long Arm and the Pine Box Payoff. Awful. Couldn't even finish it. Like you, I tossed it.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite a few I started. I was just like, eh, you know. Now I have hundreds of dollars in credit at various used bookstores in the area, thanks to Long Arm. So, but and still have an exhaustive Long Arm collection at home. It's like it never ends, you know. You can't really see the movie anywhere, but we do recommend you check out the books. They're better anyway. And, you know, we're going to keep on reading them, I think. So I feel like Joan's coming on to read some more Long Arm and try to explore these stories. Eric, you got
it? Yeah, I kind of want to dive back into it.
Yeah, anything to plug this week?
Well, I'll mention this because it kind of coincides with the plug. You can go to my channel. It's just my name, Eric Zaldivar, for now. I wonder if I can change the title. You can go to my channel on YouTube where you can watch the movie Long Arm, which I don't recommend unless you like the books. Mm-hmm. You can watch that for a limited time. I am going to take it down, but once this drops, I'll leave it up for about a month or so. And so catch it before it's gone.
Okay. Noted. All right. Well, I guess I could just say for the Midnight Movie Cowboys, peace out.
Well, good night.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.